You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of November 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
I think it would be disastrous for one administration to tear up an agreement that a previous administration made would be almost unprecedented.
The head of the CIA says that it would be a disaster if Donald Trump ended the nuclear deal with Iran. But will the incoming president listen to him? Also ahead...
Of Raul Castro, Fidel had said, "If you think I'm radical, wait till you see my little brother." Now Yankee-hating little brother Raul is reportedly ready to take over temporarily in Cuba for his sick brother.
Fidel Castro spent decades ensuring that his little brother, Raul, would replace him as Cuba's leader. We'll discuss how best to manage a political transition. We'll also be asking if burning a flag is a right that should be protected. That is all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome indeed to Midori House. Today my guests are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at UCL, and also Daniela Peled, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. A warm welcome both back to the programme. Good to have you with us. The head of the CIA, as we were hearing, has said that any attempt by Donald Trump to end the nuclear deal with Iran would be disastrous and the height of folly. But will the president-elect listen to him? Kathleen, perhaps we'll start with you. Even if Trump did want to do this, is it as easy as clicking his fingers to roll back something that was so hard won?
Well, can I just say, first of all, it is ridiculous to say something was unprecedented, which would probably stimulate him to try to do it. It's not easy. Can I say it reminds me, we historians do this sort of thing, that when Dwight Eisenhower was going to become president in 52, he was a general, remember, and the previous president, Harry Truman, said, "Poor Ike, he's going to come into office and he's going to say, do this, do that, like in the military, and nothing will happen." So Trump is going to have that sort of difficulty. The problem is that he does not have a sense, I don't think, of the intricacies of unraveling these sorts of things. And unraveling that sort of thing, when you think of the business arrangements that have been made by his own countrymen as well as others, it's not going to be an easy ride, I don't think.
Well, and Daniela, we should also point out, this isn't a deal explicitly between the US and Iran. It was the P5 plus one, you had the European Union in within that capacity and others. It's very complex. They're all rather happy with the way this is shaped up.
Yeah, even the people and the actors that have had issues with it have made their peace and they're willing to support it. It's not like it's a bilateral deal that America can just walk away from. I mean, what Trump can do if he wants is clamp down on aspects of the deal in a way that Obama did not. I mean, Obama was quite keen to cut the Iranians a certain amount of slack when it came to, you know, a bit too much heavy water here and a bit of sort of bad behaviour there, and also went to extra lengths to try and ease the process of reintegrating into the economically and financially. So Trump can quite easily be a bit more hardline that, and that is the way he can send a message. I mean, in my many nights awake, lying there thinking what is going to happen to us over the next 4 years, I've come to this slightly comforting conclusion that actually he wants to do things for effect. He wants to make statements. Mm. He wants to make grand gestures that don't actually involve intricate negotiations and long-term, well-thought-out objectives. So with the Iranian deal, that's one way he can put a marker down. I mean, the other issue as well with the Iranians is that he's made it quite clear, as far as Syria goes, he's on the side of Assad and the Russians, which means, by extrapolation, that he is also siding with the Iranians. That adds another layer of complexity. Mm. He kind of needs them from that aspect.
A layer of complexity that he doesn't realise he's adding, perhaps. We'll come on to that Russia question in a second. But just to pick up, Cathy, what you were saying about the historian's approach, just generally, I mean, Daniela said there, thinking what Trump might do gives her sleepless nights. Do you worry about a lack of almost respect for the lessons of history? Because Trump's already hinted that, you know, we could see, yeah, sanctions back against Tehran. We could even see sanctions back against Cuba flying in the face of everything that's happened in the last few days. You know, a president that so outwardly, almost explicitly broadcasts his ignorance of history and the lessons of it. That must, I don't know, do you find that particularly sort of depressing?
Well, of course I find it depressing, but I've found this depressing about the American government for the past 30 or 40 years. Mideast, for example, Kissinger and so forth, assuming it was all about communism and nothing to do about religion and so forth, and age-old conflict. So this isn't entirely new. But you're quite right. Trump takes it to an entirely new planet. One only hopes that if he gets his transition right, that there will be people in office, one hopes, to whom he will listen, who will have some experience and have some sense that the world did not begin on the 8th of November, and that he isn't at a standing stop. And also remember that he, as was Daniel said, he does things for effect. And what I wonder about is that all of these decisions he's making are going exactly against a lot of the comments he made for effect. And what is that going to do over the next several years to his electoral base?
Hopefully it will shrink them.
Well, or it could just be that everyone realizes his rhetoric is truly empty and that therefore we shouldn't worry when he makes one bizarre pronouncement or another. I guess the proof of that will be in the pudding. Daniel, just come back to this point you raised about Russia. Well, tangentially, are we in a weird situation here where we mentioned, you know, the P5+1, the EU being happy broadly with the Iran agreement? Are we in a slightly strange situation where Europe may, on this issue, be sort of hoping that actually Putin reigns in Trump a little on this?
Well, wow, that's hard to get one's head around. I mean, when I said that I was lying awake worrying about what Trump would do, I'm also lying awake worrying what Trump won't do. And that involves what action he won't take to counteract Russia's ambitions. I mean, he also can have a massive effect on the world by doing nothing, and not just in this particular sphere.
And that's not the lesser. Many say, look, that's the lesser of two evils, at least if he's isolationist, if he's standoffish, if he's so worried about people's short-term view that he does nothing, that's a better option?
Well, I'm not sure. Certainly, if you're in the Baltic states, I don't think you would think, anywhere around, I don't think you would think it was an option. Or in
the Far East, for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many areas in which inaction is just as bad. But I mean, one of the issues with him ducking and diving and making apparently contradictory statements that he is keeping people guessing. And if he's a businessman, he wants to make deals, that could be a strategy. I mean, he might not be the most intellectual of figures, but he's not stupid. You know, he's without getting too insulting about it, he's certainly cunning. I mean, the media strategy since he's been elected of creating all these scandals over things like Hamilton and the famous Farage tweet. I think he's very good at distracting attention when other things are going on. And so similarly with this strategy of saying, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do the opposite, and then I'm going to do something else. I think it's, you know, you keep people on the back foot. You're unsure about what's going to happen. And that's quite a powerful tool at the same time.
Excuse me, just to pick up on that point about Syria. It was interesting. We were talking about the CIA director, John Brennan, who warned Trump that it would be disastrous and folly to end the nuclear deal. He also said he needed to be wary of Russia, particularly over what's happening in Syria, of course. And Brennan has said the Russians are hell-bent on gaining what he calls unlimited battlefield successes there. And you look to the experience on the ground, it does rather look that way. To pick up again on this idea of being worried about Trump's ability to handle these sorts of affairs, does he have the smarts, whether it's as a deal-maker or just as a blusterer, to address really rather profound problems like that?
Well, it's not so much that. I mean, I presume he has the cunning. I quite agree with that, which is not quite as good as being canny, sadly. But it's going to depend who's advising him. So I think we go back one step and see to whose advice will he be listening. I mean, he can say, I'm going to send 100,000 soldiers someplace, and the Pentagon will have to say, well, we would have to take them out of Korea and Germany in order to get them. He's going to learn, I suspect, that there are limitations to what he can gaily do. And that's going to come the first time he tries that, or the second time, or whatever, fairly early on. He's going to find there are limits to what even a greater United States can do, just sheer logistics and resources.
And interestingly, Daniela, another thing Brennan said was he sort of cautioned Trump on the language he uses, specifically regarding terror. And we've grown familiar, sadly, in this campaign. It was a campaign of vitriol and invective, and people talked about, you know, unprecedented rhetoric for a presidential race, and that it was anything but presidential. Trump seems unlikely to take that on board, doesn't he? A warning about language specifically. And that can be a problem, not just in diplomacy, but in how people perceive terror or terrorism.
Yeah, it's absolutely a problem, an enormous problem. But then why would he listen to the head of the CIA? I mean, he's just another expert. And as we have found here with our Brexiteers, people are sick of experts. That's exactly the issue. And certainly Trump isn't interested. And it's important to look at who he's his top pick for head of the CIA. I believe it's Mike Pompeo. Yeah. But who is one who was a massive critic of the Iran deal and is going to say to Trump what he wants to hear. And I don't think moderating your language on radicalism, on Islam, on immigration, on terrorism is going to be one of those messages.
Let's move on. The recently departed revolutionary leader Fidel Castro spent decades preparing his little brother to take over from him as Cuba's president. The transition, when it finally came 7 years ago, was relatively seamless. But across the Straits of Florida, as we've been suggesting, things haven't been quite so straightforward. Obama's just a few months before his successor arrives in the Oval Office, and he certainly wasn't expecting that person to be Donald Trump, I think it's safe to say. How best to ensure a smooth transition of power? Two rather different cases, admittedly. Kathleen, what do you think about this? Interestingly, with the Castros, a family affair, and we know that America rather likes a political dynasty as well, of course. Is it ever a good thing to have a sort of a dynastic handover? Fidel to Raul Castro seem to work fairly smoothly. But what comes next? You know, these are big questions. What do you make of it?
Well, Cuba's interesting. You're quite right. It's a family affair, or the family would quite like to keep it, I suspect, as a family affair. In 2013, Díaz-Carrel was appointed as the first vice president. So in 2018, when Raul Castro is meant to leave, and he said he'll retire then, he'll be not quite as old as his elder brother, but getting on for it. And so he will take over. But one remembers that it's unlikely that he will stop being head of the Communist Party and head of the armed services. Now, there's two things. On the one hand, Fidel Castro's ex-son-in-law, who's a general, of course, is in head of Gesta, which is the great organization of military economic dominance. They take care of roughly half of the economic arrangements and economic economy, shall we say, imports, exports, businesses, and so forth in the country. And his son, Luis, I think his name, and I can hardly remember anymore, there's so many of them, who's a colonel, is head of counterintelligence. Now, those are the next generation, and people might not be quite so happy in seeing what looks like, in a non-monarchical government, an all-people-equal government, to hand to them. So in one sense, there will be a transition. We will all hope it will, sort of, as the older generation falls off their perch, there will be others in place. But I think out of respect for the Castro name, I shouldn't have thought there are going to be immediate uprisings on the streets of Havana.
And the difference is quite stark, isn't it, Danilo, if we do look across to the United States? We've often had tricky transitions before, and perhaps we can talk to Kathy in a moment about some of those in recent history. Even the Clinton handover had its problems. Even the relatively friendly George W. Bush to Obama transition, there were lots of changes in personnel and so forth, which maybe we'll come back to. But they're kind of guaranteed as tricky a transition as they could ever have had, I guess, with this unknown quantity awaiting around the corner. It's hard to know even how an Obama White House could really prepare for the Trumpageddon that's unfolding.
Well, first of all, I don't think the changes on the ground in Cuba are going to be that massive and that fast. I mean, for years and years, people were theorizing that when Fidel Castro died, the regime would fall with him. And it's been shored up. I mean, Raul has introduced all kinds of reforms and changes. And certainly, politically, things are still very tight. Economically, things have been relaxed over the last decade or so. You've got tens of thousands, if not hundreds and thousands, of cuentapropistas, people, small-scale private entrepreneurs. And for instance, my organisation, the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, a couple of months ago, we organised a conference for Cuban media in Miami. And we brought 25 independent Cuban journalists over for that, which would have been unthinkable 5 or 10 years ago. They were let out and allowed to come back. But they also told us that since the detente was announced, that human rights abuses have actually increased and repression has increased and the clampdown has increased. There's been no movement on that. So my greatest fear for Cuba is, and I think the Trump presidency would facilitate this, is you see economic investment, you see a kind of Starbucks relationship where America is interested in business and business opportunities, of which there aren't many. As for human rights, not so much.
Maybe that's a good dose of realpolitik. What about the US transition? It's funny, isn't it, that in such an advance, supposedly the greatest democracy in the world, jury may be out post November the 8th, it still seems so almost amateurish. You know, there's many suggestions that Trump and his team, now admittedly, maybe they didn't think they were going to win, simply didn't realise the sheer number of people they'd need to appoint and the amount of work that would need to be done. How are we facing that situation in the greatest democracy on earth?
Well, that's a problem. Democracy, you see. The Obama transition was about as well prepared as it could be, and it was still difficult because things happen. I mean, think about what Trump has to do. He's going to have to appoint 4,000 appointees before the administration begins. 1,000 of those have to go before the Senate, and as we all know, once you're up, you have to hand in a CV. You are investigated. Whether you've been in anything that might be difficult, sneaky business dealings, your tax affairs. The FBI investigates it all. So you have to be careful about appointing people who might be difficult. And I can see David Petraeus having some difficulties in this, for example. They don't even have to go back very far. Just look at the last hearings. And the problem is that, I mean, there's absolutely no protection, no preparation, probably because he thought it would jinx his chances if he did anything like that. But the best laid plans for this do get tripped up. Remember one of Obama's appointments he wanted? She couldn't do it because she'd had wasn't paying Social Security for her nanny, who was an undocumented immigrant from someplace in Central America. So you just do not know. But the do not knowness in this particular transition is multiplied 473,000 times because the focus does not yet seem to be on any appointment that is not newsworthy. If it doesn't look good in front of Trump International, we're not hearing about it.
And it's not helped as well, but quite a significant number of security experts and people simply do not want to serve in his administration.
They don't want to have their past unfolded. Who wants to have, some of us wouldn't mind it, I suppose, around this table. But you think about it. You've had a very varied career. You're quite high-powered. Why should you have your life pulled back like an onion to be spending, well, maybe you want to, but it just seems you would have to think very carefully of whether you wanted to put yourself and your family through that.
That kind of scrutiny. It's striking, Daniela, isn't it, that we can have these issues. And these are, in a sense, apolitical issues because people are unwilling to be, have their past combed over like that. Why does this not work better? I mean, do you look around the world for other models of political transition? I mean, in areas of your expertise across the Middle East, of course, we've had these kinds of dynastic handovers as well, and people who've tried to lay a solid foundation for a successor or someone they're going to anoint. And it so seldom follows as easily as that. Why is that? Is that because people want, when they are told there's a change, they want to feel or see real change? And if there's anyone who's got ties to a former administration, it grates, I guess, with the electorate. Is that the problem here?
Well, absolutely. I mean, democracy is messy, and dynasties can carry on and carry on and carry on, but only as very rigid structures where nothing changes and often involves quite a lot of repression. You bring someone in to any to a newspaper, to a business, to a university department. They want to appoint their own loyalists. They want to appoint their own people. I mean, I think it works best where you have a stable and perhaps even excessively large civil service that just kind of motors on of professional appointees that are scrupulously nonpartisan. And that keeps your central core of government going. It's inevitable with every reshuffle, you're going to have this upheaval. But it's also not a bad thing. I mean, I wouldn't prize stability over everything else, certainly not in political transitions.
And Kathy, maybe just finally on this, it's interesting, at least in the US you have, you know, a two-term maximum. It's all fairly, I don't know, regulated, I guess you'd call it. Where you've had a particularly commanding figure, now whether that's someone who's held power, like Castro, in an unquestioned way for half a century or so, or just where you've had someone who's gone through legitimate channels but has been a titanic figure, you think in the UK post-Margaret Thatcher, there seemed to be a sort of a weird settling period for the domestic political scene. Think of someone like Angela Merkel, you know, could win another term next year. Post-Merkel Germany, it's hard to imagine who would be the figurehead, isn't it? When you've had someone who's had, if not charisma, who's been such a steadying hand for so long.
Yes, of course, to half the people, that's not something they want. They would quite like to have someone else's steadying hand. Yes, I mean, Margaret Thatcher was a good example. So was Franklin Roosevelt, who was in his fourth term when he finally succumbed in 1944. And it's an opportunity to change policies, as they did in America when he died, 1945, sorry. And it's a possibility of changing people. People get tired, you know, and they don't necessarily want to continue hanging on. It's hard work being a secretary of ... I suspect. And also, I suspect as well, if it's not your main line of interest, you probably gradually lose interest, and thirdly, you think, oh my God, here comes the same problem around again. So there's a lot of self, people wanting to go out as well as changes. I agree with Daniela. Stability is the second most important, but new ideas and approaches is probably the first, as long as there is the stability underneath.
A good primer. I hope some of these people are listening. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Kathleen Burke and Daniela Peled are here. Coming up, should the right to burn your country's flag be safeguarded in law? And is a ban preventing women in Saudi Arabia from driving about to be lifted? Stay tuned.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
At 1822 here in London. Now, Donald Trump, him again, he has said no one should be allowed to burn the American flag. If they do, there must be consequences, perhaps a loss of citizenship or a year in jail, he said. But is that unconstitutional? 25 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that flag burning was expressive conduct and protected, therefore, by the First Amendment. Still with me, Kathleen Burke and Daniela Peled. Kathleen, let's come to you first of all. It was interesting. We've already speculated about Trump willfully, you know, redirecting the media away from issues of substance to issues of things that he can, you know, play to his established gallery. Is that what's happening here? And even if it is, what do you think about the substance of what he said?
Well, it's either that's what he's doing or he's displaying quite amazing stupidity. It wasn't a small page 16 article when the Supreme Court said you cannot stop this because it's a free expression. Therefore, you have a constitutional right to burn the American flag if you want to. So, I mean, full stop, that's it. It's the law. And it's the law that could only be changed by 2/3 of a vote in both Congresses and 2/3 of a vote in 3/4 of the state. This is unlikely to happen. Now, burning flags, American flags elsewhere, we can quite rightly get, Americans can quite rightly get righteous about that. But short of him sending a drone over and doing something about whoever holds the match, it's unlikely to cause much more than a lot of growling in a lot of Americans. No one likes to see their flag burnt. You have an instinctive reaction against it, I think. But there's nothing, at least in America, that you can do about it.
And it's also worth remembering, of course, that in that Texas v. Johnson case, the late Justice Antonin Scalia, for whom, you know, Trump has regularly proclaimed his admiration, and he was very much on side with that judgment. So yet another example, I suppose, of Trump not being concerned by the fact that his position seems rather contradictory or hypocritical.
He probably didn't have a constitutional lawyer at his side, or a son-in-law or a daughter who actually knew all that much about constitutional law as well. It was a throwaway comment to mobilize his base.
Now, speaking of the sort of global impact of this, Daniela, it always struck me as rather interesting that in various demonstrations around the Middle East, there was always a ready supply of Stars and Stripes flags ready for burning. I always wondered, where did they come from?
Made in China.
Did somebody just have a big old vat of those and they just break them out whenever?
It's not a party unless you burn a flag. I mean, these demonstrations are very rarely, with the exception of the Arab Spring, these demonstrations are rarely spontaneous. They're usually very, very, very well prepared by government figures. So that wouldn't be at all surprising.
But why is it? It's funny. I mean, I was thinking about this when we were posing the question in the office earlier. The whole flag burning debate doesn't really happen here in the UK much. I guess there'd be an isolated instance, but it's not something that people get fixated about. Is that because there's not a prescriptive constitution that safeguards that very kind of expression? Why do people not get so hung up on that in this country?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we do the whole burning of the guy on November the 5th, which is basically a symbol of burning a Catholic at the stake. You know, I'm not sure we perhaps do that so much now. I think it's been somewhat sanitised.
The meaning has been lost.
Some thought it was also a burning of Parliament. It was a pro him having a go. So that's historians are a bit
so
mixed on that one.
As long as you get your incendiary feelings out somewhere, that's fine.
Put a sign.
But I think we're also a little bit more subtle about our expressions of political dissent here, and that would be seen as rather too extreme, too hateful. And certainly the idea that it would be illegal is hard to get your head around. I mean, we don't have a constitution. It wouldn't be a matter of that. I think what's important in these circumstances is that you have an interplay between people who want to ban these things, and then legal powers and a Supreme Court that doesn't want to. I mean, this is people complain and people say that we should, and people that say there should be censors. I mean, that tension is what creates and supports freedom of speech. I'm not bothered by the idea that people say, oh, it should be an offence or you should be thrown in jail. I think citizenship stripping is a little bit exaggerated.
It's a bit different in the States, remember. You grow up pledging allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
So what
to
the flag. The symbolic
it's the queen.
Is deeper there.
It's the queen. It's deeper. And even though you may not have lived in America for decades, you can still say it if you're asked.
Interesting.
Remember the U.S. is organized around an idea, not a continent. I mean, now, obviously, but when it was an idea, and it's this idea, symbolized the flag, that provides the glue holding together the American nation. Now, Britain has the Queen, which if you want to have a symbol that everyone recognizes, and you don't pledge allegiance to the Union Jack. So it's a very different situation, I think.
It is indeed. My favourite, just as a last note on this, was when so a few Brexiteers tried to burn the EU flag during the Brexit vote, and they couldn't because they're all fireproof due to health and safety regulations, which was delightful. Time is short, but quickly, Saudi Arabia is the only country in the world where women are forbidden to drive. But could that be about to change? A member of the Saudi royal family, Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, has said the ban should end and there should be no debate. Daniela, in a word or two, I'm assuming you agree with him?
No, you know what? I could not be less impressed by this statement. I don't. It's utterly meaningless. It's a sleight of hand. It only means something if it also is accompanied by equal rights for voting, equal rights for travel, and equal rights in the law. This isn't the sort of incremental change which will lead to great progress. So I think he's just showing off, frankly.
Kathleen, do you go along with that? Is an empty gesture or is it a tiny step in the right direction?
I'm an incremental woman. I think that any breakdown of barriers is a good thing. After all, they can go to university now. They didn't used to. That changes. If they can drive, that gives mobility. It gives freedom. I think it's one of the few times I really don't agree with Daniela.
There we go. We end with some divided opinion after all of that unity through the show. Kathleen and Daniela, thanks both very much for being with us on the programme. That's all we have time for today on Midori House. The show was produced by Rhys James, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Khan, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next. 1900 Daniel Giacopelli's here with The Entrepreneurs, and we'll have more on all of the big stories of the day on The Monocle Daily, 2200 hours London time. This show, Midori House, is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for tuning in.